order. Today's Thursday, March 8th. We're in an unusual kind of situation to members of the audience in that the House is on one schedule, the Senate is on another schedule. And if at any minute it might change where the House will have to leave or I will have to close committee because of Senate floor session. So we apologize especially to friends who've come from so far across the state. But what we'd like to do is to have you, Dr. Allen, or Dr. Higginson, to come and introduce the partners that are with us today, and let's hear from them since they've come apart, and you guys will come back at another time. How does that work?
That works very well.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Great.
First, I'd like to invite Linda Fleming, who's the Executive Director for CLO, to present.
Would you formally introduce yourself?
I'm sorry.
That's right.
I'm Dr. Susan Allen, the State Public Health Director. I appreciate the flexibility in your schedule to allow us to make sure that the people who have come, who are community partners, have an opportunity to speak on behalf of their interests in our programs.
Okay.
We'll start with Linda.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Linda Fleming. I'm the Executive Director of the Coalition of Local Health Officials. We represent Oregon's 34 local health departments. I know that time is of the essence, so I won't try to repeat a lot of what I know you heard yesterday that was very well presented by Dr. Allen. I know that she described to you the various public health services, as well as her office administrators will be filling in even more detail. The point I would like to make is that as counties, we are not vendors of the state services. We are our partners in a system that prevents disease, promotes healthy health habits for healthy living, and protects communities. And as being a partner, we work together very closely and in joint cooperation. I'll give examples of how that cooperation, that partnership works. We work directly with them on several grant applications and assist them getting millions of federal dollars into the state of Oregon with those grant applications. We jointly develop, approve, and adopt standards for local health department operation across the state in an effort to have consistent application of public health policy and practice across the state. We develop and approve the program elements that make us accountable to our funders, to governments, you, county commissioners, the governor, the Department of Human Services, and our communities primarily. We take that very seriously. In addition, we jointly develop and implement funding formulas in pursuit of statewide equity and sustainability of public health programs. And this year, over the last year, we went one step further and jointly developed mutual legislative priorities to bring into this body and focus on quickly those priorities were communicable disease and our urgent need for better capacity in communicable disease control and public health emergency preparedness. Safe drinking water. Safe drinking water is critical not only to the safety of our drinking water throughout the state, but it's also critical if we're going to maintain and retain the state revolving loan fund, which so many water systems depend upon to improve water systems throughout the state. Public health nurse home visiting services, that's a top priority for us. In the last year, we provided home visits to over 9,200 at-risk children. These are children with medical conditions and medical diagnoses. That those 9,259 children received over 33,000 public health nurse visits in the home as an extension of the primary care system. And last but not least, we have what we refer to as an umbrella of child health. We are embracing the governor's Health the Kids program as it funds critical services, public health services around school-based health centers, dental sealants, and those types of things. To further demonstrate our partnership with the state, the Association of Oregon Counties, and if you turn to your last stapled paper here. The Association of Oregon Counties, at the end of the last legislative session, embarked upon what we refer to as Project 5520. That was an effort between the leadership of Ways and Means, the Association of Oregon Counties, and the Legislative Fiscal Office to describe just exactly how we are jointly funding our shared services across the state. First of all, and I've attached for you the kind of hot off the press result of the public health services to show you how public health services are being funded at the local level across the state. The public health chart you see there represents 25 counties, over $109 million, and approximately 1,700 local employees in the public health system. I'll just try to walk you through that this real quickly so you can kind of get an idea of what the different divisions really mean. The federal state contract is the actual contract, the money that you are looking at in the Department of Human Services budget that goes directly to counties in their contracts, special payments to counties. The federal contract, those are competitive federal grants that are available to counties that they can get directly from the federal government without having to go through the state. State contracts, those are state contracts to counties that don't necessarily go through the Department of Human Services operational contract to counties that actually may even be with another state agency. Federal direct, those are Medicaid payments that we receive for our services. Primarily, those are services related to family planning and, again, to public health nurse home visiting. State direct, those are several counties have contracts with other state agencies outside the Department of Human Services to provide local services for that agency. Other intergovernmental agreements, your local health department might have a contract with their Commission on Children and Families. Several have contracts with their school districts. Some might have contracts with their fire department and police department to provide services. Fees, I think, are pretty self-explanatory. Under other, those might be grants, small grants that we're getting, for example, from the March of Dimes or other nonprofits. And the last big chunk there, 27%, is county general fund. I used to come before this body and testify about our three-legged stool when I talked about funding. Basically, it's what we get from the state, what we get from the county, and what we generate in fees. As you can see, keeping public health afloat in this state, at least at the local level, has become a much more complicated and complex issue. It's no longer a three-legged stool. It's more like a banquet table with multiple legs, and it even has one of those little crossbars under the middle to keep it from sagging from too much weight. So you might ask yourself, well, given this, what happens? Our public health system in this state, I think Dr. Allen testified yesterday, is in the bottom five in terms of funding. So if any one of these legs in this pie chart becomes adversely impacted, the system starts to sag. In the federal-state contract, the underpinning, that bar, has become the preparedness money. That's what's been holding local health departments up now ever since the disaster of 9/11, the funding we get from the federal government. That has been declining. We don't know what the amount will be this year, but from a recent January article in the Oregonian, we probably can anticipate that it will go down again. Federal contracts, those are competitive, so counties may or may not get them. They may or may not even be available another year. Same thing goes with other state agencies and state contracts. Maybe that state agency has a contract or a competitive grant that they're, so we have an opportunity to get that. The Medicaid, the federal direct, we are very concerned about that. The president's budget and new rules around Medicaid match are putting some of our programs in real jeopardy of being severely, underpaid this time around. Other intergovernmental agreements, of course, those agreements are very dependent upon what Ways and Means gives them. So if they don't have the money anymore to contract, with the local health departments. It's another piece of the pie that goes away from us. Fees are generally are pretty stable, but they're only stable if we have the staff to provide the service. So if we're impacted in any of these other places and hired staff, we can't generate the service that generates the fee. So it's just kind of a, as you can see, the complexity, and you know, people work on this year in and year out, just how are we going to fund this, how are we going to keep the doors open, how are we going to maintain the capacity to meet the needs, and as I said again, to prevent disease, promote healthy habits for good living, and protect communities. How are we going to do it? The County General Fund, as you're aware, is being impacted at the federal level. We also have some counties that have not been able to pass public health and safety levies, and so on, therefore are finding a decrease in funding. In the governor's budget, there is $5 million that will go to state support for public health, which would greatly help us. It would double the per capita spending right now that goes into communicable disease prevention and surveillance. That is a big help for us. The Department of Human Services originally requested $18 million. So as you can see, $5 million isn't going to solve the problem. But quite frankly, it's $5 million than we've ever had before, and we would, you know, I just want you to know how critical that funding is to our communicable disease and preparedness programs. There's another approximately $3 million in the Safe Drinking Water Program. That is critical to us. We have nearly 30% of our water systems that are at risk. But as I said before, I was a mayor of a small town. I know how important it is to have that state revolving loan fund to help with the construction and enhancement of drinking water systems. So it's not just a public health issue, but it's a local infrastructure issue that's just critical. The additional match for family planning expansion program, that's just critical to women's health, reproductive health, and women's health care in this state. And there are multiple other small pots of money in the proposed public health budget that we would encourage you to support. The one area that is not been funded is the public health nurse home visiting. There was a request for a $2 million expansion that did not get into the governor's budget. Again, that's a critical program. We would encourage you to work with members of this body, to work with us, the Coalition of Local Health Officials, and the Oregon Nurses Association, to find a way to better fund that program that makes it sustainable into the future. These are critically at-risk children. They have medical conditions and medical diagnoses and are referred into the public health nurse system by their pediatricians, neonatal intensive care units, pediatric nurse practitioners, and other. It's a critical program, and we would ask that some thought be given to how we could find a way to improve the funding base for that program.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Representative Nathanson.
Thank you very much. I do apologize for getting here late, and I understand that you are Ms. Fleming?
Yes.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
I'm looking at the list here of Oregon's public health gaps.
Yes.
And I need your help. I want us to understand how we can have a list that is titled Targeting Oregon's Public Health Gaps, and we do not see eliminating health disparities on the list. How did that happen?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I believe that we were looking at broad program areas across the board and believe that within those health disparities is a part of all of that, particularly in the areas of communicable diseases. We know that we have populations, what we might call subpopulations, that are more adversely impacted than others, and we would consider that to be a part of that. The same thing with public health nurse home visiting. We reach out to the various communities. I know in your county, of Multnomah County, they have a very comprehensive program of public health nurse home visiting to reach out to other communities. And probably it was just an oversight, quite frankly, on our part, not to clearly state that that would be part of the objective and goal.
May I be frank with you?
Certainly.
I'm going to tell you that that's an unacceptable oversight. The elimination of racial and ethnic health disparities needs to be an explicit part of our work, And not to identify it as a Oregon public health gap is a problem and a concern. And I would commend to you the Oregon Progress Board report that looks at the progress of Oregon's racial and ethnic populations in a number of benchmark categories, education, employment, also inclusive of health, that you and other members of the Coalition of Local Health Officials sit down with that information, that data, and find ways to internalize those findings and those recommendations into your work and into your advocacy. Without doing that, we're going to miss a lot. We're going to miss targeting our programs and services to shifting populations, new populations. We're learning how to do some things and how to do them well in some of our counties, certainly in Multnomah County. But our learning is based on our understanding that we need to be explicit in saying what it is we're going to look at and why we're going to look at it, and then what are we going to do strategically to address the issues and concerns. So that's what I'm asking for. That's what I'm looking for. And I'd like to hear a commitment as a from you as a representative of the organization that you'll take that message back and that we'll start to hear a message that's more inclusive, that needs to be inclusive and reflective of where we are in 21st century Oregon.
Madam Chair, Senator Gourley, thank you for the input, and I did write at the top of my paper exactly what you said, and that message will be carried back to the membership, which in fact will be meeting next week, and I guarantee you that it will be a part of my legislative report.
And I would add, if I may, Madam Chair, that the Office of Multicultural Health and the Department of Human Services is a resource to you. I would also offer that, that would be an excellent place to start. Yeah, that
American.
Together with the
African American Health Coalition.
The African American Health Coalition. Thank you, Senator Carter. That's another. And then going back to examine the findings and recommendations that came out of Governor Kitzhaber's Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force. Mm-hmm. We're still struggling to implement the recommendations that were brought forward in that report, which was 1999, 2000, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. And the full implementation can't take place unless we are taking seriously the recommendations and that we do the struggling together and the learning together to figure out how we move all of our communities forward. And that's, I want you to hear my comments in that spirit. I am offering constructive criticism, but it's about how do we move all of our communities forward so that they are experiencing the highest quality of health. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Nicholson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have three questions. And since Representative Boone, Representative Kotek, and I may be called away at any moment, I'd like to tell you all three questions and at least get them on the record. And these questions, I understand, may be answered by you or possibly with some supplemental response at some time from Dr. Allen. The first is referring to what Senator Gourley was just the page that we were looking at. On communicable disease, it says Oregon ranks 48th in immunization rates. And I'd like to know, are there policy or procedural issues that keep us down so far in the national standard, or is it exclusively a funding issue? My second question is on the chart that you've presented to us. In the area of fees, showing that that accounts for 25% of the revenues, are those fees for services paying, is it services that are paying for themselves, or are the fees in part subsidizing other services or programs within public health? And the third question, when I look at the complexity that you pointed out to us, the variety of revenue sources, there are three places, actually if not four, because other intergovernmental revenue indirectly depends on state funding. So given that, but particularly for federal state contracts, state contract, and state direct, is this a good thing or a bad thing? That all of the revenue sources that involve money coming from the state come from many different offices or agencies. Is it a good thing or a bad thing that there's such a wide variety rather than coming from a central source such as DHS or whatever?
Madam Chair, Representative Hinson, I'll try to go through these one by one. First of all, the 48th in immunizations was reported in a December 5th, 06 Oregonian article. Probably the best person to answer that would be Lorraine Duncan from the Department of Human Services. However, I do know that Oregon is unique in that we have populations of people in pockets around the state who kind of lost their understanding of the importance of immunizations and think, well, we don't see that anymore, so I'm not going to expose my child to the vaccine. We have groups of people who believe some of the stuff out there that these vaccines cause autism. So a lot of it, quite frankly, I think, is an education outreach problem. In terms of the fees, 25%, those fees, for example, a lot of those fees are like licensing fees around restaurants. We are required to put those licensing fees back into the food service program. Immunization fees, we are required to put those fees back into the immunization program. The same thing goes for family planning. So I guess what I would say is, yes, the fees that are generated support the program that they are generated by and are not to be used to subsidize other things. In terms of the complexity, do I think it's a good thing? I guess I'd say a yes and a no, in that it's not a good thing in that we have our local public health agencies scrambling constantly to find who has money where for what. Number one, because you know that's how we're keeping our doors open and keeping ourselves staffed. So when those real emergencies and those communicable disease outbreaks happen, we have somebody sitting there ready to go. It's a good thing in that if other agencies are wanting to do what we would consider to be public health activities at the local level, it's good that that the local public health agency is the one that's doing it versus several people who may not have the public health expertise that we do.
Thank you very much. Dr. Allen, the next presenter.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, who is this
one? Okay. You may not be able to answer this, and I would, if you can, agree, but don't pull back if you can. The county general funds you have listed here, excuse me, I'm losing my voice, the county general funds you have here, do you have any idea how much of that is O&C funds? I mean, some counties put a lot of money in, but they have no O&C funds, and some counties do and some don't. Do you have any idea what that 27%, what percent of that might be on a statewide basis, O&C?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I can't tell you what percent of that 27% is O&C or other timber revenue in Public Law 106.
Okay, thank you.
That would be good information. If you could get that back to us, Dr. Allen, that would be very good information.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, what we will be able to show you is a spreadsheet that identifies the county's contribution to the local public health system and what their vulnerability is for O&C or timber fund losses. We probably will not be able to show you specifically if it's the timber funds that are going into the local health department because it's not clear that the counties track the money that way. But we can certainly show you
we can compare the quantities for the two.
Madam Chair, may I offer too that the Association of Oregon Counties has actually put together a very good spreadsheet by county in terms of what the general fund impact will be and the road fund impact will be by county. And actually you will be able to see then, it also shows on that spreadsheet by county what percentage of the general fund or discretionary fund is related to timber revenues. I know that they put that together in January 2007, and I would suggest that probably Gordon Fools could get that to you quickly.
Well, after this question, I'm sure Gordon is definitely going to get this to us. Here is the challenge for us, because if the dollars that the governor spent depending upon revenues to be raised, if those revenues are not raised, I don't need to say yes, do I? And so, therefore, you're going to have to make, Gordon, your argument around the fact that if we don't get the revenue raise that was projected in the governor's budget, I think all of us are in a little trouble in this state.
Thank you.
You may.
Thank you. To follow up on that, thank you for being here. Are the counties talking about across-the-board cuts? And maybe that's a follow-up with the counties, but are they just holding out public health departments out there as a threat? Or are they looking at, if, for example, if timber payments are 5% of their general fund, are they looking at cutting all general fund-funded, county-funded things by 5%? Or are they targeting? Have you gotten a sense from the folks in across the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I really can't answer for boards of county commissioners and how they're doing. They are just now entering into their budget development process. And I know that the Association of Oregon Counties is anxiously awaiting to see how those budgets filter out and exactly where were the cuts made and what type of a prioritization process was developed to do that. I do know some counties have gone through a real prioritization process with their communities, and the communities have helped them to decide what's the most important thing to them to be preserved at all costs.
Thank you. Dr. Allen, I do know that you have some other presenters, and we want to give them the opportunity since they came to present. So,
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much. And certainly the local health departments are our strongest and most consistent partners across a whole range of programs, and I appreciate having Linda Fleming here. The next presenter is Dr. John Ju, who works as an emergency room physician in a number of capacities in emergency preparedness and emergency response in the Portland metro area, and also serves as well as an advisor at various state functions at the state level.
Thank you. Both of us from Portland know Dr.
Ju
quite well.
Thank you, Dr. Allen, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Jonathan Ju. I'm a nurse physician at Oregon Health and Sciences University, as well as the EMS Medical Director for Multnomah County. I'm actually here with my third hat on as Chair of the State EMS Committee. My perspective is actually in strong support for the public health department and its budget for three big reasons. The first reason is integration of services, health services. Public health departments, in particular the state, is when strong, is the honest broker for a health services that are, frankly, is under stress. And my rural colleagues know this better than I do. Over half or three quarters of all the rural hospitals are critical access hospitals. In fact, only in the Willamette Valley and in Central Oregon are hospitals at full functioning. So let me define critical access hospital. That's a hospital less than 25 beds. Translated, what is happening in Oregon is a lot of the more complicated cases and cases that require significant intervention are being transferred into the valley and into Central Oregon to St. Charles. So there is a huge change in the delivery of rural care to our rural colleagues and our rural population as well. That requires a significant infrastructure as well as relationships that are being developed. And my point here is that public health, often at the county level, but when not available at the state level, is the honest broker, and that broker needs to be strong and need to be an advocate for its constituents as well. The second real issue, and Senator Gorley alluded to this, is disadvantaged population. No one in our state, besides certain of us, public health, is really looking after the disadvantaged population, particularly ethnic, but socioeconomic. There's a lot of rural Oregonians out there with no access to care. Public health is the honest broker again that actually attempts to achieve access to care, actually delivery of care, and actually watches that population who often doesn't have a voice in either government or any other public modality to speak for themselves as a constituent base. So I think everybody knows that, but I just need to repeat what is inherently obvious to us. We see this on a daily basis. About 40 to 50% of my population either has little or no care when I take care of them in the emergency department. They're in the ED because they have no place to go, and no funding, and no doctor's office, and nothing. No money for medications. There's drug and alcohol that's rampant through some of our people who are less disadvantaged, and that's continuing to be a problem as well. Point here is that disadvantaged care, there's a lot of interventions, and a lot of them are public health. Drug and alcohol withdrawal, drug and alcohol treatment, maternal and child prevention, injury prevention. I mean, I can tell you, I saw last weekend about four or five, usually male, usually 80-year-olds, on roofs that fell down. I'm getting very tired of taking care of the elderly people that are falling off of roofs or on ladders, and that's becoming very tiring as well. Finally, I think the other thing that's happening is that we are looking at, again, integration of care. Let me give you an example. The care that's occurring right now, a good example is a STEMI, which is an acute heart attack. And we actually have in the Portland area and many places in Oregon, including the Willamette Valley and Central Oregon, are actually doing electrocardiograms in the field. That has led to earlier cath interventions, in other words, opening up the heart, and better outcomes and hopefully better survivals. That's a particular specialized portion and specialized services, but it requires integration of care. Again, public health is the one that actually measures that that issue here, and frankly, we don't have a database to know what we're doing. Senator Gorley can look me straight in the eye and says, "How are you doing it?" I can say, "Well, in Multnomah County, I have something." But the rest of the state of Oregon, you go to LeGrand, you go to Baker County, ask them for the outcomes, they don't have enough money. I mean, they can barely get out the door. I mean, this is not out the fault for them. Mm-hmm. But their services are not well-funded, and they're volunteer. And frankly, they're doing it out of their goodwill. And so that actually, you need to know that when you actually decide on the funding.
And this bill will help with that.
Yes. And finally, I'd like to say what's inherently obvious. Some people that don't know me, I'm also the deputy commander of the Oregon Disaster and Medical Team. We are at, in Oregon, at about 95 to 98% capacity as far as our ability to take care of patients. If we actually get hit by a disaster, in particular pan flu or name your illness, we actually had in the Portland area norovirus that actually put a significant stress on our hospitals from the elderly that came in nausea and vomiting as well. Public health is the, I would say, cornerstone for our surge capacity and our disaster response. Without a good public health response, we're in deep trouble. And we, our cornerstone for that kind of response inherently is in public health, and that is one of the best reasons why we need to thoughtfully think about its funding. Outside of that, that concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Questions? Yeah. Dr. Bates?
Thank you for coming today. You know how busy you must be, and sort of share that with you a little bit. And I do want to make a couple of comments real quick. I appreciate what you've said, and I think what you're giving us is good information, and it's right on, spot on. But I do want to say a couple of things about some of the rural areas you may not be aware of that needs to be said. First off, we have SafeNet clinics working very hard throughout the state right now, and in my part of the country, down the Rural Valley, they are the backbone of what we do as far as taking care of populations that are not served. A clinic that especially takes in the population population that is often overlooked in our community, the Latino population. You have to be a Spanish-speaking physician to even work there, and I think that's a good requirement. Okay, I mean, they are working very hard in this area, and I don't want them overlooked. Public health is not the only one out there doing it. The real push and shove for me in this budget is going to be very difficult. Is that on one hand we have a failing health care system, which is a bigger problem that we're dealing with here, and we have a situation in many of the rural areas where the EMTs are not properly trained, they're volunteer, their ambulances are crumbling and falling apart. It's just the system is falling apart from that point of view. And as far as providers are concerned, you know, we're one step away in many areas of not having a physician there to do the initial work to get them shipped into you. In my particular area, again, we're one neurosurgeon away from going back to a fragmented care system. We're one or two thoracic surgeons away from having the same problem. So the question is, how do you deal with both of these things? Build a better coordinated system, spend money there to coordinate a system, but if you're coordinating an inadequate system on the ground, it doesn't do you any good. So we have to build both these units at the same time. And it's a difficult time. It's a difficult time.
I agree with your comments.
Thank you.
I don't have a crystal ball, but they're both medical care providers are actually rooting for public health to do some of the heavy lifting. The other heavy lifting is the providers themselves. And frankly,
right,
the economic reimbursement access to care issue has to be solved in our state.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jeffrey. I just want to tell you guys under a call.
Oh, thank you.
I believe
I
was
called a house.
I just appreciate everything. Are we really?
What I heard is that the session has been called, but it is not a call of the house yet. So we may have a couple of minutes, or we may not. I think I may.
So you can finish with your question now, Representative.
Oh, I was just being smart. I just was asking Dr. Jew what he did with his spare time.
Oh,
I appreciate everything you both do. Very nice.
Thank you much, and I'll be back in the audience if you want to talk to me.
Thank you. Thank you for being with us today.
And Dr. Allen. Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to. We will be changing direction a little bit, but I think it's important for you to hear from a nurse who works in one of the school-based health centers that you will hear more about later in one of our program presentations. It's Debbie Knox, who works at the school-based health center in North Eugene, if I have that correct.
Thank you. Hello, Madam Chair and members of the community. I'm Debbie Knox, and I'm talking today in support of school-based health center programs. I work at a school-based health center in Eugene, and I've worked there for 21 years. I was one of the people that wrote the grant that got the clinic in place, and I work with a nurse practitioner that's been there 21 years as well. So arguably, you could call us the grandmothers of the clinic program in the state. I don't believe that I would have stayed with a program this long if I didn't passionately believe that this mode of health care delivery to children is by far the most elegant model that exists out there. Having a health center right where children spend most of their day puts a health center staff in the unique position of being able to develop rapport and familiarity with the kids.
Excuse me, Ms. Knox,
sure.
They have to go into the house.
Yes, love to hear you. Bye. So anyway, they have an opportunity to develop the rapport and the trust and the relationship with kids so that they can deliver the comprehensive health care that kids need. I am just going to share a couple stories with you about to put kind of a face on the kind of kids and families that we work with. The first story that I want to tell you about is this takes place at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Friday before spring break. A young man who's new to our school, he's a ninth grader, came in, and he had just moved in with his aunt because both of his parents had been put in prison. And our nurse practitioner had been in the back room. She had just done a positive pregnancy test on two kids, on a couple, and they were crying in the back. And I'd gotten called down to the gym for an injury, and a young man came into the clinic, and the nurse practitioner poked her head out and asked him what he needed, and he said he needed a lozenge. And typically, you know, in that situation, you probably just throw him a lozenge and say, see, have a good vacation. But something made her ask him why he needed a lozenge. And what he told her was that he was so incredibly thirsty and that he had not been able to drink enough water to quench his thirst, and he'd lost about 12 pounds in the last 2 weeks. When he complained about his symptoms to his aunt, she told him to take 2 aspirin and go lay down. Nancy, our nurse practitioner, handed him a cup and told him to go pee in it, and which she thought was odd, but went ahead and did that, and sure enough, he was an emergent diabetic. And by that time, I'd gotten back, called the ER, told them that we were going to be bringing in this kiddo that was very, very ill, and went by the house to pick up the aunt. I put him in my car and went by the house to pick up the aunt because she didn't have a car, and got them both to the ER, and he was put immediately in intensive care. Now, that young man could have gone home. His aunt could have told him to take 2 aspirin and go lay down, and he could have lapsed into a diabetic coma and died. That's not too far-fetched of a situation. When he got back to school, we also continued to work with him and monitor his diabetes. The other story is about a 5-year-old little girl who was in a homeless shelter that was close to our school, and she needed to have some dental work done, and mom had told the nurse that her daughter had a heart murmur. So when kids have heart murmurs, they often have to be put on prophylactic antibiotics to make sure that they don't get a secondary infection from having work done in their mouth. So we had the mom bring her in, and our nurse practitioner listened to this little child's heart and heard the worst heart murmur she had ever heard in all her years of doing nurse practitioner work. So she contacted CDRC and got the child in to be evaluated by a cardiologist. And the cardiologist heard the heart murmur and cleared his schedule and had this young child in his surgical suite the next week because it was a very serious thing. And it turns out she should have had the heart surgery. They were from New York originally, and they should have had the heart surgery right after she was born, and she didn't. So she'd been dealing with this heart condition for 5 years. But because we were able to act quickly, she got it done because this was a very nomadic family. So those are the kind of situations that we deal with, and these are the kind of situations that are being dealt with daily in all of the health centers, the 44 that we have in the state of Oregon. They have hundreds of stories just like I do. And we're in the unique position right now of having a lot of support from our governor and from state and federal legislatures. And I just want to thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about this and really encourage you to continue to support the work. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Thank you.
I was one of those people on the beginning end of health clinics, school-based health clinics in this state, and I'm just really very glad to see you're still there.
Yeah.
I was in the house when we did this, and so thank you for your work and commitment to service.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Dr. Allen.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to hear from our partners. Also, just to make it clear, we're hoping not only will the school health clinics, school-based health clinics still be here, but that there will be more of them,
yes,
perhaps in the future. We'd like to, with your permission, resume where we left off at yesterday's session, if you believe we have any time left.
We don't have time left. We have 2 minutes, actually, and we would have been very generous with our time had you had other partners, but rather than for you to get started again, why don't we wait until Monday?
Do you think you can do it in 2 minutes, Grant?
I can do it in 2 minutes.
How many minutes?
2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're timing.
Okay. Again, for the record, Chair Cardon, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the administrator for the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, State Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. And I just
That's
need to tell you two
have.
Things. just need to tell you two things today.
Okay.
And the first one is not a policy package, but it is something of interest. And if you look on page 41, you'll see healthcare licensing and certification. Yesterday in my discussion, we went over that we set standards and then actually survey and license licensed and certify over 500 agencies and facilities. And what we'd like to see for a standard is to have on-site inspections at least every 3 years, where we allow an outside agency to come in and accredit. We'd still like to be there at the exit interview and receive all of the reports. And then the third thing is we'd like to be able to do aggressive follow-up on all the complaints we receive and all of the deficiencies that we find in surveys. And I just want people to know that we're not anywhere close to meeting that standard at the current time. Some things that we do, like ambulatory surgical centers, we get to about once every 8 years. And you might ask, why isn't there a policy package for this? And we started on one, but we miscalculated and did not realize that we needed to have a legislative concept, because some of the fees are in statute and not rules. So we're working with the industry right now to try to come up with something that is agreeable in the way of a package to get us to a place where we could meet that standard. And like I say, it's not a policy option package right now, but it's something that I want you to know about, and I know that Senator Carter has been interested in this issue and will be working with her and others.
Absolutely. I'm trying to get a bill together with that right now, colleagues. Did you guys hear what he said?
Mm-hmm.
Once every 8 years? If I was an Oregonian and knew this information before today, I would fire every legislator that is here. I mean, really and truly, there is no reason why we should be inspecting healthcare facilities once every 8 years with the kind of disease factors that we're finding in hospitals and other places today. That means all of us are at risk. All of us. And that's a sad commentary. So I'm having to put some things together right now along with Senator Monica Anderson to see if we can find some dollars for the health department to progress their time a little less than 8 years in order to do this. And so we will be talking from then on. Are there questions of Dr. Higginson?
Well, Madam Chair, just a comment. Hospitals are going to a very careful and very distinct inspection, far above what the health department does. They do it usually every 2 years. Sometimes if they don't pass the inspection, every year and a half. And I don't think you're referring specifically to hospitals. You may not get around to them, but ACOG does. And tell you what, that's a tough inspection to go through. A whole team of people comes in and goes to the entire hospital. So that's, we shouldn't be concerned so much about the hospitals here, but I am concerned, as you are, mm-hmm. about some of the ancillary facilities right. out there that are not being inspected regularly, and that is a problem. So I want to make sure you understand the hospitals, from my point of view, are not a problem here.
And Chair Carter and Senator Bates, JCO does do a fabulous job, and we accept that accreditation in lieu of doing our own inspection. I do think it's so important for us to be there at the exit interview so that we know what's went on in
exactly.
that survey, but we do not want to do anything in the way of duplicating what's already been done and been done
right.
well. And then the final thing I just need to mention is on page 48, there's a policy option package for the medical marijuana program. And the way we got here is that for a long time we had a fee of $150 that led to a cash balance of almost $1 million in 2005. So just before last legislative session, we reduced the fee to $55. During the 2005 legislative session, $900,000 of that cash balance was taken out to fill gaps in other parts of the department, and consequently we've had to raise the fee back up to $800. So that's the Senate Bill 333 policy option package for medical marijuana.
So if the state didn't steal your money, could you have still done it at $55?
Chair Carter, I don't think we could have done it at $55. The idea was $55 spend down for 2 to 3 years.
I should not have asked you that question. Thank you, Senator Bates.
Madam Chair, are we going to have a chance to come back and have in-depth discussion about immunization programs?
Yes. Yes,
thank
we
you.
Are.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for your time.
And we will see you on Monday.
Look forward to it.
Thank you. Committee dismissed.